baby.
So far, I have twins who are 7. The 7-year-old is urgent on the that's going to be excruciating.
You guys ready? Okay. All right, I think we're going to get started. Good morning, everyone. My name is Rob Freudenberg. I'm the Vice President for Energy and Environment at Regional Plant Association. I'd like to welcome all of you and thank you for choosing this very important panel called Climate Justice for All. I'm going to give a very brief introduction to the topic before putting the panel in the very capable hands of Kate Sinding Daly. Kate will lead a conversation with our highly respected panelists and will make sure to reserve about 10 minutes or so for audience Q&A. So as you're listening to the panel discussion, please be sure to catch the thoughts that get triggered in your head and bring them to our panelists in the form of a question versus a statement. This is like Jeopardy, right? So now, as we heard in Tom's remarks and from the great plenary panel earlier this morning, climate change is probably the most important challenge we face today. Although if you're in this room, I guess we can say it is the most important challenge we face today. And as we delay confronting it with the full set of actions it requires, it's becoming even harder and more expensive to address. Now, as a challenge, climate change is particularly thorny because it is as multidimensional as it is inequitable. I mean, what other topic ripples across virtually every aspect of our lives, from where we live and work to how we get there and back, to the food we eat and the products we purchase, and so much more? Virtually every decision we make has the potential to contribute to climate change. This is why solutions to climate change have proven so difficult. It requires us to change. And while change is harder for most, try to imagine how hard it is for the 33% of people in our region who are just getting by, living paycheck to paycheck or with little income at all. Or someone who's grown up in a world riddled with the injustices of racial bigotry cemented into our policies and other systems. Climate change may not be the first thing someone in this very real scenario thinks of when they wake up or the last thing they think of before going to sleep, but the impacts on them are nonetheless profound and pervasive, and they exacerbate the challenges they already face. And picture this. It's an extremely hot summer day, the kind of days that trigger warnings from health departments to do everything you can to keep cool. Picture you live in a neighborhood that shares space with one of these so-called peaker plants. These are power plants that only turn on when demand on the grid exceeds supply of the everyday grid. They're typically older and dirtier than other power plants, and as a result, impact the air quality of those around them. It's not surprising, then, that the asthma rates and other respiratory illnesses are higher for people in the low-income communities of color that disproportionately bear the burden of these plants. Climate change will lead to more days of extreme heat, and thus more days where these peaker plants turn on until we find another alternative. And now picture on this very hot day if you're someone trying to save some money by foregoing what seems like a luxury of air conditioning. On days like these, not having access to cool space could be the difference between life or death. Apartments without air conditioning have been found to be as much as 7 degrees hotter than outside temperatures, and they don't cool off at night. That's significant when you're talking about 90-degree days or higher, and if you're elderly or a small child or health compromised. And I could walk through a completely different set of issues for low-income neighborhoods in flood zones with all too similar outcomes, whether it's an increase in mold growth in illegal basement dwelling units resulting from the wetter days we're having, or the difference in options for low-income residents or renters in the aftermath of storm damage that can cost more and take longer to complete when compared to those with greater means. What I'm trying to convey is that climate change makes bad conditions worse for those already struggling, and the impacts are getting worse themselves. So as we take all important steps to address this challenge head on, we need to be sure that our solutions don't perpetuate the same tired and cruel cycles. And with the support of New York Community Trust, RPA has been working on these issues in Queens communities with the group Make the Road New York. Through research, resident surveys, and interactive workshops, we've identified a series of recommendations for those neighborhoods at the personal, neighborhood, and city policy levels. We'll be releasing a report called Equitable Adaptation that summarizes our work together and pathway forward soon, so be on the lookout for that. But to talk more in depth about this issue, we really have a terrific panel. I'm going to hand it over to Kate Sinding Daly, who is the executive director of Northlight Foundation, which is the family foundation of Dan and Cheryl Tishman, It focuses on advancing equitable and enduring solutions for environmental and human health. Before Northlight, Kate spent the better part of a decade at NRDC. Kate will briefly introduce the rest of the panelists, and then we'll launch into a conversation with them. Kate?
Thank you, Rob. And welcome all. It's a real pleasure to be a part of today's panel and to be with these terrific panelists. So as Rob said, I'm just going to quickly introduce them. You have their full bios in your materials, and then we'll launch into a series of questions. So to my immediate left is Dan Zarilli. Dan has a couple of titles, Senior Director of the Climate Policy and Programs. But you're also the Chief Resilience Officer in the Office of the Mayor for New York City. To Dan's left is Assemblywoman Neely Rozic, who represents New York's 25th District, which is in Queens. To her left is Anna Baptista. Anna is the Chair of Environmental Policy and Sustainability, the Environmental Policy and Sustainability Management Program at the Milano School at the New School, and also dear to our heart, she's the Associate Director for the Tishman Environment and Design Center at the New School. And then last but not least is Amy Chester, who is the Managing Director for Rebuild by Design. So Dan, I'm going to start with you. As probably everybody in this room knows, from the outset, Mayor de Blasio saw it as critical to include a co-equal focus on equity in One NYC, which is the city's comprehensive plan for attacking growth, equity, sustainability, and resiliency. I'd like to invite you to give us an update on One NYC and specifically to focus in on how equity and justice are centered in the current plan.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks, Kate, for that. And thanks, everyone, for being here. It's a real pleasure. You hit it right on the head in terms of Mayor de Blasio, of course, came into office with a focus on addressing the tale of two cities and really bringing equity into everything we do as a city government. And certainly our climate change work, our strategic planning work is no exception to that. In 2015, we put out the first version of One NYC and really married together our environmental sustainability and our economic sustainability work together and set a new tone for how we think and talk and act about these issues. And not only did we raise the bar and commit to an 80% reduction by 2050 of our greenhouse gases, investing billions of dollars in climate adaptation all over the city, we also made strong commitments on lifting New Yorkers out of poverty for the first time, putting a number on that, 800,000 over 10 years, and we're right now on track to achieve that. So really thinking about these issues and the issues that Rob laid out so forcefully as interconnected issues. This is, you know, I think that one of the biggest challenges we deal with in talking about climate is how hard it is to talk about it because of how pervasive it is. It's not just, you can't just put it into the environmental bucket and think of it as many other environmental issues because it does connect to every part of our life. It's also a really, fundamentally unfair issue and is not something that is far away happening to someone else 100 years from now. We're seeing the impacts. It's here. It's now. Whether we're seeing that in increased heat deaths in New York City, whether we see that in flooding impacts, it's happening here, and of course it's happening across the globe. And so for us, it was critically important to think of this as a human issue and one that is directly connected to how we think about equity. And so that was 4 years ago. We put out a plan thinking about sustainability and resiliency and growth and equity together, and it's been 4 years since we've been doing that. I think you heard in the earlier session this morning that we are on the verge of putting out a new strategic plan, a new One NYC next week. And some of the things that we've been doing to build up to that, I think, highlight the need to raise our ambitions. Our understanding of climate continues to get stronger and stronger, and the crisis, the emergency, and our awareness of it continues to grow. And so we need to be challenging ourselves to think about how to accelerate this work, how to be bolder, we need to continue to push the conversation and get others to act as well. Big props to the City Council yesterday for passing the building mandates, the retrofit bill. So I don't know if anyone here is representing the City Council. Thank you for passing that bill. But we've also done some other things in the recent last recent weeks. The mayor has announced that we are eliminating and ending our reliance on single-use plastics as a city, any unnecessary single-use plastics. We're not going to be buying them anymore except for a small stock for those who need them with disabilities. We are reducing our fleet. We're leading by example. We continue to retrofit our own buildings. We're investing heavily in and moving forward the plans in Lower Manhattan for Lower Manhattan coastal resiliency. A whole suite of things, and we've got more planned for next week that really, I think, brings to life some of the conversations that are happening nationally about how do we accelerate this work, how do we connect it more broadly into equity agendas, and thinking about this as job creating, about how it's connected to our healthcare and education and how we bring more people into this conversation. Well, in reality, that's exactly what's happening here in New York City already, and with things like the mandates and with more to come, we are, I think, demonstrating what the kind of leadership is that we need on the federal level that's not there right now. We're demonstrating what it looks like here at the local level.
Thanks, Dan. Assemblywoman, in addition to your role as a member of the Assembly, you chair the Office of State and Federal Relations. So I was hoping that you could discuss how you approach the issue of climate justice, both in your district and as a statewide issue.
So that's a great question, and I think Dan sort of gave you a taste of it at the end of what he just said. So from my perspective, we can't really rely on the federal government to lead, especially under this administration. So I think it's really incumbent on local and state governments to step up because we have a tremendous opportunity, but also huge responsibility on climate justice and climate change. I got elected in 2012 in a September primary. Superstorm Sandy happens October 2012, sort of throws some of our election into chaos. I represent Queens. I don't thankfully represent Far Rockaway. That was completely underwater. But my election was November of 2012. Going up to Albany as a newly elected official, I thought everyone would have their eyes, ears, and focus on infrastructure, resiliency, climate change. That was not the case, right? So before, I guess this is 7-8 years ago now, 7 years ago, I'm aging myself, people were not talking about climate change. The Green New Deal was not a thing. At the state legislature. Certainly not amongst the Albany infrastructure as it was, like the people who had been there forever, but even amongst newer members, like no one was talking about climate change, and especially no one was talking about economic justice and social justice as it relates to communities of color and how they would be impacted by climate change. So I sort of started working on these issues, whether it's through our correctional systems and making sure that, you know, our prisons upstate are starting to look at being resilient and having solar energy as part of their plan, but also working in tandem with what the city of New York is doing and leading on the state level on all sorts of issues. I would say on a more local level, it's really important for legislators to lead on climate change, especially in communities in the outer boroughs where they don't like change, right? I have a lot of parkland, a great quality of life. You know, we like the way things are. And for me, it was meeting people where they're at. So we started implementing, with the help of the city, rain barrel giveaways. I had to teach new immigrants and East Asian communities how to use rain barrels. We started giving away bike helmets so that people are starting to use that as an option for transit. And it's really about, and we gave away hundreds of reusable bags in all of my senior centers so that we are changing behavior, that we are changing people's minds, but also behavior. And I think that that's a really critical piece in all of this.
Thanks. And obviously, since you first went to Albany, that's changed and that
totally.
Conversation's happening now. So maybe we'll get to
that a little bit
further in the conversation. Anna, you have been a key player for many years now in both the national and regional conversations around justice, climate justice, and just transition. Obviously, those conversations are both in Albany and at the federal level now, more important than they've ever been. And so I was hoping that you could provide your perspective on what those concepts really mean and look like. They're terms that were that are getting thrown around and maybe mean different things to different people. So if you could provide your perspective on that, that would be terrific.
Sure. I'll put on my professorial hat. We do hear the term climate justice more and more now, and it does beg the question of, do we all mean the same thing when we talk about climate justice? I like to think about not just we often talk about what climate injustice looks like, right? It's easier for us to sort of identify in our minds what the injustice is around climate change, but what does the justice look like? This is some of the key themes around climate justice that have been talked about and are talked about within the environmental justice movement and globally in the global south are things like root causes, thinking about what are the root causes of climate change. And for some people, the root cause of climate change is an extractive economy, late capitalism. It's really a product of a political and economic system that exploits people and the environment. And so the two things are connected. It's not just a carbon problem. It's a human problem. The other element is rights, human rights. And what are our human rights in a global society? What is the share of the global ecosystem that we take up and that other people take up? A third is reparations. And in the context of a global warming and the debt that we owe in the North to the world because of how much space we're taking up ecologically. And so there's a lot of discussion around what do we owe one another in a justice framework, not just in an equity framework. And then the fourth, and I think one of the most important things, is participatory democracy, a real commitment to deep, deep democracy. And we talk a lot about meaningful participation and engagement of communities, but in climate justice will require us to center solutions at the front lines, at the points of impact, of the points of greatest impact. And that's a totally different way of doing things than the way we do them now, where most of our decisions and our actions start from the top and make their way down. And one other framework that's getting used a lot now, particularly with the Green New Deal, is just transition. And what does this mean, this term, just transition? It used to just mean like how you transition oil workers or coal miners to new jobs in the economy. But today it's taken on a much more nuanced meanings. And there's a beautiful graphic that's done by the Climate Justice Alliance. So if you look them up, Climate Justice Alliance, or ourpower.org online, you'll see this beautiful graphic. And it talks about how we move as a society from an extractive economy to a regenerative economy. And what the principles are that are embedded in that transition. And how do we not only bring workers along into new fields of the sector, not just the energy sector, but the entire economic systems, but how do we bring in people who were never part of those economic systems, workers who never had an opportunity and were marginalized. And so that means really shifting a lot more than just our energy sector. It means creating opportunities for not just controlling the consumption of energy, but the production of energy, for example. So I think that's my version, at least.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll get an opportunity to dig into some of that a little bit more. Amy, in your work to advance resilience strategies both in New York and across the country, what have been the key components from your perspective necessary to center equity and justice in the conversation?
So thank you. I am the director of Rebuild by Design, which started as a regional challenge here after Sandy and now works with cities both around the U.S. and around the world. I have a little cold, so. I think, it's interesting. I feel that I can't even answer that question because I feel like it's the communities themselves that really need to be answering the question of what they think equity looks like in their policies. There's been a lot of cities that have worked to include equity. New York is one of them. Boston is another. Los Angeles is another. And I wonder if the communities who are really experiencing the inequity believe that the policies that are being implemented are actually going to make that difference, whether or not they are at the table. I think having the communities be part of the policymaking is probably the most important thing that we can do. The second most important, or equally important, is that the communities themselves have to be represented in our elected officials, in our policymakers, in the staff of mayor's offices and things like that. I'm obviously white. I live on higher ground. I live in Brooklyn and Ditmas Park. I'm out of a flood zone. And I, you know, dedicate my work to helping people who aren't that. However, I don't feel like we can really speak for them and we can judge whether or not we're doing a good job. We have some really good examples of cities that are trying to do this well. And it's usually as a result of communities that have worked for many, many, many years, and then the city has finally woken up and have decided to implement a policy. And whether or not the implementation of that policy actually mirrors what the communities, you know, wanted or is going to be for us to see over time. I'm thinking of an example of a policy that I've been following in Miami, the Miami Forever Bond Act, $400 million, that communities had been working very, very hard to allocate. It's a property tax increase to allocate for resilience. And the communities on the ground were the ones that worked for it, and they are the ones that wanted to make sure that it's not just resilience, it's also affordable housing. So you're dealing with some of the climate equity issues, not just the infrastructure issues, so the communities can maintain, you know, to be at the table. And it's interesting because when it gets implemented, it's elected officials that are deciding how to spend that money. It's not the actual communities. Communities do have an oversight board. I think it's met once, and it's interesting to watch, but I don't really think that we as policymakers have figured out how to actually accomplish this. Yeah. A long-winded answer.
No, not at all. And it provides a good segue to my next question, which I'll open up to the panel in general, which I wanted to focus on that question of examples, because again, we can talk about the theory and we can talk about the design from the front end, but I'd love for all of you to sort of reflect on some examples of where you've seen this work, the centering equity, done particularly well or conversely not so well.
I have a couple of examples. I came ready.
Right.
You told me to bring examples, so I brought some examples. I'll give you two examples. One is the work that's happening in Illinois, and I don't know if anyone's following. The Illinois state legislature passed the Clean Energy Jobs Act, and they passed an amendment to go with that act. And if you look at the amendment to the act, there are environmental justice is mentioned 30 times in that act. And the reason for that is because of the work of grassroots, frontline communities all around Illinois and the Midwest Environmental Justice Network who pushed back on an original version of the bill that had lots of great 100% renewable energy targets by 2050, but had very little to say about who was going to be the benefactors of that and how, what the process would be to get there. And so the amendment is a wonderful 30-page document, SB 2132. You should look it up. And it has detailed prescriptions about how you create workforce hubs and networks centered in frontline and in impacted communities, both in the rural parts of Illinois and in the cities of Illinois, to create jobs and apprenticeships that are living wage jobs that are connected to different parts of the economy, not just the energy sector. And it has real targets that require emissions reductions of co-pollutants from every sector. So it's not just reducing CO2 molecules, it's reducing co-pollutants that impact the health and well-being of communities now. So that's a great example, and it's really the product of grassroots organizing and activism. And then the second one is more local, and I have to bring it back to my hometown of Newark, New Jersey, where the state of New Jersey just passed a stormwater utility tax or fee. It's not a rain tax. But that was very much supported by frontline and environmental justice communities who experience flooding, but not only that, want the opportunity to create stormwater task forces. And in Newark, the Ironbound Community Corporation is actually forming the state's first stormwater cooperative. So they are going to be training and apprenticing a whole cadre of residents who are underemployed or unemployed to be able to contract with cities all over the region to do stormwater upgrades to meet the utility requirement. So again, it's connecting up real opportunities for economic justice with climate justice.
And here in New York, you have the CCPA, which is the Climate and Community Protection Act, supported by over 170 different organizations, including a bunch of environmental justice organizations, but Make the Road, which was mentioned earlier, and has passed in the Assembly for the past 3 years. Again, with the change in Albany, hopefully we'll see that make its way through the levers of government. But the interesting part in that is that it really identifies that communities of color and low-income communities are the ones impacted most by climate change. And so 40% of state funds from the CCPA would be directly targeting those kinds of communities. And that's a big, broad strokes answer to climate change at the state level, but we've taken little bites at the apple. We did the ban on plastic bags last month during the budget process, something that personally I didn't think would happen even 2 years ago. Right? I was one of the 18 members who said, you know, no to overturning the city version of it. But again, built into that bill was this this kind of option for localities to say, we want a fee on paper, or do we not want a fee on paper? That might work for some communities, that might not work for some communities. And then another example is obviously congestion pricing, which, as was mentioned upstairs, does not get, you know, the environmental kind of spin that it should. And in that regard, you know, we did a carve out for low-income communities who would be impacted, people making under $60,000. But if we're going to talk about equity and diversity, we also need to talk about geographic diversity. And for me personally, I represent a district without any subway or train stations. Yes, I represent the, you know, New York City, but out in a transit desert, you know, it's really hard for people to take two buses to a train to get to work, and then, or conversely, taking a bus from Queens to the Bronx to work that job early in the morning or late at night at the hospital, and inserting that angle, that perspective into congestion pricing was really critical for communities like mine. When we're talking about how we're making real change for the entire region.
I think great examples. You know, I think it's helpful almost in my mind to think about this. There are good project examples and the work that the city has done on cleaning up air quality and the way that it's been particularly focused in communities of color, and we've seen some of the biggest gains over the last 10 years, is a great example. The work we're doing to invest in heat mitigation in neighborhoods that have the highest heat vulnerability, which also align with neighborhoods that have the highest poverty and communities of color. The mandates bill, I think, is a great example of aligning this just transition and connecting the job creation with our need to cut greenhouse gas emissions, but also protecting affordability of housing. And pulling all that package together was incredibly complicated, as you can imagine, but I think it was a really successful outcome. But I also think there's a way of thinking about this in terms of some of the movements that are happening that are pushing this. And it's really exciting to see a lot of the youth-based movements and Zero Hour and others that are really changing the conversation. It almost, to me, it feels like there is an intergenerational change coming in our politics that is much more attuned to these issues and thinking about equity and how it connects to the climate challenge. The divestment movement, I think, was a precursor to that, and really exciting work that happened across campuses and has now spread to cities. And you know, now New York City and London, the two great financial capitals of the world, are partnered together on a divestment forum, and we're trying to bring other cities along on that. And that didn't happen by itself. It happened because of a grassroots-led effort that really put some wind in our sails to be able to make a change like that. And so I think all of that, I think, really shows that there's a – an evolution of how these ideas of equity are incorporating themselves, not just in the projects and the individual projects where they must, but also a little bit more systematically and systemically across how we work as a city and how we as cities work together across the globe where, again, national governments aren't doing, you know, what we would want them to be doing.
Amy, did you want to add anything on that one?
No, you
don't. Okay. So I think the lot of great examples provided here, some of them more at the project level, some of them at the big policy level. So my next question is really about how we get to the next level of evaluating what it really means to. So it's, let me back up. I think the Illinois example, the Clean Energy Jobs Act, is a terrific one. CCPA, another of how there's been an inclusive process, a hard-fought inclusive process that's led, in the case Illinois, successfully to a legislative outcome. In New York, we obviously have an incredible window right now. And the fact that the governor introduced his sort of answer to that certainly suggests that there's the possibility to come out with something very strong. But how do we, looking forward to implementation, this concept of, you know, not leaving anybody behind, how do we think about how to actually evaluate the implementation of those policies after they're enacted?
I mean, I don't have an answer, but I think one of the things that we need to do is put some of those targets into the legislation up front and how we're going to track and implement and how you'll correct yourself if we don't meet those targets. Because I think so often communities work so hard and they get that, you know, they get that win. So I worked on congestion pricing now 12 years ago. I was part of the team that created Plan YC. My job was congestion pricing 12 years ago. And watching this session was amazing. Of course, I'm super excited. But the fact that the all of the carve-outs didn't go into the legislation but is now going to be decided by a commission that has not yet been appointed, and who knows if they are going to be accountable to communities in New Jersey or Long Island or New York City or places where there are a lot of congestion in New York City or not. And I think that unless we start taking on the responsibilities of ensuring up front that there's only one way to do it and there's only one right way to do it and it can't get implemented in a wrong way, we're not going to see the real change that we need.
I think it's also important to remember that, you know, as legislators, from my perspective at least, you know, I try to be the Jill of all trades, but I'm not necessarily the expert on everything. So when possible, working in tandem with organizations or with this, you know, the city of New York, kind of tweaking legislation from the past or creating plans currently, we rely on experts to inform our decisions and what we hear from all of you in this room. I'll give you a small example of that. So 10 years ago, there was a tax abatement created for developers or buildings that want to put green roofs on their buildings, okay? In the last 10 years, only 7 have been approved, all buildings in Manhattan, right? This is a statewide program that has only impacted 7 buildings in Manhattan. So that issue was brought to me from the controller, the city controller's office. They did a great report on this. And I said, okay, well, it's up for renewal this year. So how are we going to tweak it? How are we going to change it so that it's more equitable for everyone in New York City, so that it makes sense for everyone? I live in a development that has gone solar, and wouldn't it have been great for a developer out in Queens to know about the program, let alone, you know, apply for it and get it? So we're going to hopefully renew that tax credit this year with an eye towards being more inclusive and more equitable. And that's just a small example, but these ideas and these kind of little levers of government come up every now and again, and it's important for all of us in the room to work together, be on the same page, and inform legislators on how we can be taking that next step.
No, and that's a great example, and the iterative process is obviously part of the answer to it. Dan, did you want to?
I guess part of what I was thinking about with this question is, in terms of measurement, you know, we have been doing a lot of look at sort of citywide aggregate statistics and disparity statistics, and you know, we have a legacy of the city and how, in a lot of ways, we're still a very segregated city that comes out of the history of redlining and other things that shows up still very much so in all of the you know, the outcomes that we see in our communities, and in a lot of cases, you know, whether it's premature mortality rates or air quality or other things, there's a clear geographic focus, and the central Brooklyn, South Bronx, Northern Manhattan, communities that pop up on every single map of disparity is usually getting a worse outcome. To me, those are the fundamental types of indicators to look at. Is when we start to see movement of those numbers, that's how we'll know we're being successful. And we need to be thinking of those sort of wrapped up indicators and cross-cutting indicators to really have a focus on whether we're moving the needle to making a more equitable city. Those are the kinds of things we're tracking. I think those are the kind of things that influence us in our decision-making of will this have an impact on those big, important numbers or not? And that has to, I think, really be part of all of our decision-making.
I'll just add a point of process, which I think for the folks in environmental justice movements is a real ouch point, which is that typically policies are designed and framed and solutions are conceived well before there's an entry point for people who are the intended target or unintended target of those policies. And so for those communities, having the opportunity not just to give feedback or to be involved, but to actually be the part of the generation and the co-production of frameworks and policies and solutions, I think is so critical and so rare. And if you're a policymaker or if you're a policy analyst, if you do this for a living, or if you're a representative, I think being able to bring in diverse voices, particularly those voices that don't typically get a seat at the table, is critical to ensuring that you have, personally, I think, empirically better outcomes. I think you get not only more buy-in and more participation for participation's sake, but you actually get a better product. And that shows itself in things like the Illinois bill, right? That bill was, you know, was only successful when it brought in multiple voices into the construction of the bill. And I hope to see more of that happening in our region here.
Yeah. And I want to
ask a question, because I think we, and just as speaking as a city rep, what you describe is really, really hard. And I think is also built on a history of distrust between government and communities, and to try to, like, I'm curious if you have any thoughts on, like, how to break through that. Like, new people coming in, want to do the right thing, have to understand the history, and have to understand the community and be able to work together. How have you seen that go well? And do you have good examples of that, or, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but please.
I mean, I do from the beginning of Plan YC. So I was responsible for the outreach in Plan YC after a time where we just lost Jet Stadium, we lost the Olympic bid, the city was kind of looking at itself and trying to figure out how did we lose this. And I started my career as a community organizer, and the most obvious thing to me was they didn't work with any of the communities on the ground to do that education, and they didn't see themselves in this. So I took the job with the intention of trying to show the Bloomberg administration that we could do something really different. And we really did. And, you know, the first thing that I did was, on my first day of work, was made a list of every single organization in the city that existed that I could think of that could have any connection to sustainability, where sustainability wasn't even really defined in 2005, and then brought them all into City Hall in groups. And these were organizations that had never stepped foot in City Hall. It wasn't even that long after the Giuliani era. We met in City Hall, and every community member was like, wow, I've never seen this place before. And just asked them, what do you want to see? What should we be studying? And we actually took their ideas. And it took a while, and there was a lot of other things that were happening at the same time. So it wasn't only their ideas, I'm not going to lie. There were a lot of policy issues that the Bloomberg administration knew that they wanted to work on, but I can tell you that the outcome of the first Plan YC plan was absolutely shaped by those conversations. And, you know, there's so many examples by the way that they were shaped, one of which was even putting the idea of environmental justice in Plan YC, which we had a lot of internal conversations, might I call them even arguments, about whether or not it belonged there. And it ultimately went in there, and that was a signal to the communities that they had, you know, a real seat at the table here to be part of those implementation. So I don't think it was, I don't think if we did it now, that would be the answer, because we've come very far since then. It's been 12 years. But I think at the time, that was a very, you know, groundbreaking idea, was to bring in the community into the conversation before we knew what we were really going to propose.
I mean, I would suggest that we have to create conditions for trust and conditions that allow for that kind of organic interaction and development of trusting relationships and transformative work to happen. So it's not going to happen overnight, especially if there's a history there that could impede that. But it's certainly possible if people who have power, who have decision-making, who have venues and convening spaces to open up and begin their process from a different place. And, you know, one example, I'm going to call out Zach McHugh here from Senator Booker's office if he's in the room. Senator Booker put out an environmental justice bill, Environmental Justice Act, 2017. And I think, you know, that office opened up the development of that bill to, yeah, I would say they have had over 38 phone calls all with representatives from all across the country, from indigenous and environmental justice communities, to shape the language of a bill and the input to a bill, which is, like, I thought was unheard of. But there, it took time, it took process, it took, you know, patience with the product, I think, is something that a lot of people around the country feel wed to, committed to, interested in, and seeing something happen. So I think you just have to make spaces, you have to be patient, you have to and be open and take some risks too, because it's true that it's hard work, and especially when there's a history there, it takes some time to develop those relationships back up.
Can I add? Thanks. I mean, Dan, you have an extraordinarily hard job because you can only maybe control your office, maybe. You definitely can't control all the other agencies and all the other decisions that happen. And I think the trust issue is the biggest one that you have to face, because, you know, you can be doing something that, you know, is going really, really, really well for a really long time. I won't mention what that could be. And then, you know, something can change that you might not have had control over, and then the trust gets evaporated. And all of a sudden, and I bring that up only because it's not just in that instance, all of a sudden it becomes, oh, the city does this to us all the time. Yeah. And then there are all these examples of how it's been done in the past, and it happened here, 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 and here, so now they're doing it again. And then the good part gets erased, and that's the part that you really work hard on. So I'm glad I'm not in your shoes. And it's easier to be on the outside. But I think it's like, it's also about. How do you internally in government make other people in government really understand that their actions is going to be a reflection on everyone else? And how do you work that out together so that doesn't happen?
Yeah. And how do you carry it through? Because back to your point at the beginning, you've got to bake the process in at the beginning. You've also got to bake it in throughout, and that's a real challenge. I wanted to. This might be sort of a silly question, but when I sent it out ahead of time, nobody told me not to ask it, so I'm going to ask it. But feel free to tell me. But I just wonder. You know, we've kind of been talking about a variety of different initiatives, policy initiatives, projects related to mitigation on the one hand and then resilience on the other. And I wondered if, and we were sort of mixing them together and thinking about justice and equity mixed together. And I wonder if you think there are any significant differences in how to approach this problem in a mitigation context versus a resilience context.
I mean, I think congestion pricing is a kind of interesting idea, right? Interesting example of how the conflict plays out. Because from an environmental sense, you don't want people to come into Manhattan, so you don't want them to pay this fee. However, if they don't pay the fee, then you're not going to have the money for the subways, which is very much an equity issue. So I think that all of these things have to be taken apart and figured out. And I think if we aren't figuring out some other sources for our transit system, for instance, we're never going to be able to achieve the environmental benefits that we want either, because we also want people to come out of their cars when they're not driving just to and from Manhattan.
I'll just mention that on the mitigation, resilience, and environment, the environmental justice movement nationally has had this debate ongoing, really in opposition to carbon pricing and market mechanisms. And the primary reason is not because they don't want to mitigate carbon or climate change. It's because they actually want to mitigate climate change and co-pollutant emissions. They want to address the underlying inequalities that exist already and use climate mitigation policies to that end as well. And so there's been typically we see climate mitigation policies, particularly market mechanisms, generate revenues that go into resiliency projects. And so those two things seem to be connected through a revenue stream that hopefully will feed a virtuous cycle. But for environmental justice communities, there's a lot of distrust, I think, among, one, do the emissions on the mitigation side, will they benefit the communities that need emissions reductions the most? So what are the emissions reduction potentials to the most impacted communities? And on the revenue side, how will the revenue actually be used in a way that anchors communities rather than helps to gentrify them and displace people? And so the unintended consequences of that system actually could produce more inequality. And so for me, mitigation and resiliency are connected, and they should be connected through this lens of equity and justice.
And there's also a local and global dynamic to that conversation as well, where, you know, by mitigating, we are having a small impact on a global problem and need others to mitigate, versus we happen to be a wealthy region and a wealthy city, and when we invest in adaptation, that has a local benefit. And so trying to really think about the equity from that point of view, from the global, of how do you spend your dollar? Do you spend it on a mitigation project that's going to have a marginal impact but scale up if others do the same thing, versus spending that dollar to protect people who are here, who you may be accountable for at the ballot box? It's a really, really challenging dynamic to think about your role on a collective problem versus a local thing that you can control. And that is rife with equity challenges, not only locally of where you spend, but also that global local dynamic.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think we should open it up to audience questions. And I see one right in the middle there.
Great, thank you. The mayor of London, the current mayor, has repeatedly said their entire mayoralty will be judged on how they tackle air pollution. And I know Anna's alluded to it, but if you solve air pollution and the pollutant issue, you will actually solve the greenhouse gas emission issue as well. My question being that London is the other greatest city on earth. And I used to work for the mayor. My question is, why don't you think New York is doing as much as London as the other greatest to solve that issue, because I think it would accelerate climate action, it would deal with those communities that suffer the worst air pollution, which are the low-income communities as well. And I'm just interested in your view. I'm not saying New York is doing nothing, I'm just suggesting why you
don't. No, well, I think in terms of just like premise of the question, I think, well, one, New York City, of course, is doing a ton on air quality.
And is the greatest city in the world.
And is the greatest city in the world. Thank you for that.
Outnumbered.
I know what you're talking about in this instance, yes. You know, when I've seen this sort of comparison of European cities and American cities, like what strikes me is the reliance that Europe went big on diesel cars and drove their air quality through the roof, and it's not even comparable in terms of like American cities are consistently well below European cities on air quality, which I think is exactly why Mayor Kahn has made that his focus, because it was turning into crisis levels. So the things that this city has done, we've continued to update our air code. Prior programs like Clean Heat and other things have had a dramatic impact. And when you look at the maps of where it's had the most impact, it's had dramatic impacts in our, in most cases, in our lower income and communities of color across the city. And really that's turned into a citywide, massive reduction in PM2.5 and other pollutants as well. So I think it's, New York City, I think, is a shining example and of actually tackling a problem that has such a core equity underlying challenge to begin with.
Anna, I'm curious, though, whether from a sort of a framing or a narrative standpoint, whether you think that an emphasis on air quality more than climate is part of how we can ensure that equity is more squarely centered in the solutions.
Well, I'm willing to try it. I'm still trying to convince. I'm trying to convince the folks who came up with the Clean Air Act, all the environmental movement, which was so successful in regulating to get us to better air quality, at least some people to better air quality. Say, why not regulate to go further to make sure, because everybody didn't get clean air through the Clean Air Act. And so when we try to introduce, what I say we, the environmental justice movement, tries to introduce mandatory emissions reductions for co-pollutants and climate mitigation, environmentalists are usually like, don't mess with the climate bills. Like, we need the CO2 reductions. That's the most important thing. And they don't want to touch the co-pollutant side because they say that's being taken care of. That's why you have the Clean Air Act. But the reality is for environmental justice communities, clean air is not a reality and has never and will not get there through market mechanisms. And so the push for emissions reductions has become a growing call and demand from the EJ movement. And we see the climate mitigation train as being the only likely train to get to that, because I don't see a new Clean Air Act bill being introduced since the 1970s. So, I mean, I would love to think that pushing for air quality would make a case. I fear that a lot of people will tell me the air is just fine, as many have done, not having gone to some of the communities that I go to. But we're hoping that the call for climate mitigation and the urgency around climate change will motivate people to think about how to attach that to improved air quality conditions.
Anna, you just hit the nail on the head, whether you meant to or not. It's until we start thinking about one another's issues as our own issues, we're not going to have climate equity for all. And until we start believing all actually means all, including ourselves, and all doesn't just mean the people who have been fighting this battle for a long time in environmental justice movements, we're never going to get there.
We might not have climate legislation at all if we don't start thinking about it that way. You want to take another question? There's one up here in front.
Hi, I'm just curious if you guys have any input or pointers to people working in the industry. If there's any sort of way that we can engage with the community at large.
What industry do you work in?
I'm in design, but I'm thinking on the building side or construction, design, even sort of building technology. This is definitely an industry that does not have any contact with community. Personally, I have contact with my community, but I'm just wondering if there are ways we can engage as an industry and if there are pointers on how we might be able to do stuff like that. It's outside of sort of the government realm.
No, it's not a weird question.
No,
it's a tough question.
I mean, partly it's a question of like representation, right? And knowing that how you hire and who is representing you out in different, you know, public forums on projects and things, like thinking about who you send and what sort of forums they're in and how they're engaging is critically important. And so it's like, you know, if you're going to be working in a community, but you're flying in people from across the country to go work in that community, maybe that's not going to go so well. And so I think that is, it's really important, I think, from that perspective to think, how do you bring those community voices and how do you hire and how do you staff your jobs and things like that to make sure you know more and can connect with communities.
Send the right message.
Yeah. I think that's a part of it, yeah.
Here's another question in the back.
Thank you. I'm Alan Kratz from Resilience Works. I used to work with Amy Chester and enjoyed working with her. My question really is picking up on the comment that was made this morning by the moderator that 100 resilient cities has closed up shop. And I think, and I'll turn to you for corroboration, I think the real actual fact is that Rockefeller Foundation, having created promotion and really started this new vocation of Chief Resilience Officer, now is turning more of its efforts to folding that work into its general economic mobility actions. So my question really is, are you as panelists sensing that the philanthropic community really is taking on economic mobility, climate justice, equity as part of their philanthropic efforts?
As the member of the philanthropic community on the, I do think so. It's been really interesting to, I mean, but not necessarily away from the climate focus. I don't know if that was sort of implicit, but I do think the conversation in the philanthropic community has gotten pretty advanced now about how we have to think about all of these issues holistically, and how they relate to one another, and certainly. The economic mobility components, the job creation components come into that. I think, you know, hopefully within the, and I'm not going to comment on, you know, Rockefeller's decision with respect to 100 resilient cities. I think, you know, the risk with philanthropy is that philanthropists come together and sometimes they do things collaboratively and then they make their own decisions and then they go and do other things. And so it's very hard as a sector to have any kind of assurances or accountability to make sure that the other pieces, the other critical pieces are continuing to be tended to. And I hope as a sector, you know, that will happen. I don't know if others have other.
I mean, I just have a comment on not specifically philanthropy, but the kind of shift. Is there a shift to economic question? You know, in the past 10 years, we went from sustainability to resilience to equity to climate justice really, really quickly. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if they are all the same thing or not. They certainly have lots of values that are the same thing. And we've watched the philanthropic community take that same shift over those years, you know, so 2007, it was all about, you know, it was just beginning to be sustainability to the place where we are now, and watched Rockefeller investing a lot in resilience and Ford investing a lot in equity, and all the really large philanthropic communities are trying to make a name for themselves on, you know, for one thing. But what they also have done is this humongous rippling effect. Of different smaller philanthropic funds that continue to invest in all of these things and keep on those legacies, and governments that continue to invest in all of these things. You know, we still have a sustainability office as part of resilience. Then it became, you know, equity became part of resilience and sustainability, and economic equity might be the next way that we're talking about something. That we're still continuing to evolve and realizing that if we don't have all of these things together, we're not going to find the solutions.
Yeah. We have time for one more.
Sort of following up on the woman's question in front, I mean, good design is good engagement, right? We're designing for the end user. And thinking about that as part of these policies, we've got a lot of policymakers up on the panel. How do we build that into the funding of some of the acts that we're passing? I think that's something that's often cut short, and I think we're seeing that with, frankly, the Army Corps of Engineers study, that they don't have funding for engagement for this huge swath of people that they're having to reach out to. So how do we make sure that that's part of the process and built into the funding structure of these projects?
So I've found that, at least on a couple of my big legislative pushes, that it takes everyone to be in it together and to be on the same page. When I passed the bill expanding bus rapid transit in the city, it took an effort not just of me as a legislator convincing other legislators, but it was all of these environmental groups, transit groups, Rockefeller Foundation weighed in and helped build organizers out in communities. They did paid canvases and campaigns around this new idea and pushing bus rapid transit in the outer boroughs. So it really takes a holistic approach. I can never pass legislation at the state level without a coalition. It's just nearly impossible. Take too long, too much effort. So I always look at issues from that lens, like who can I get involved that will work with others, that will support others, and ultimately help me get it across the finish line.
We can do one more? Okay. We have one over here.
Thanks, Kate. I've been following the city and state plans to rebuild the BQE Expressway along the Brooklyn Heights waterfront. Mm-hmm. And as you know, without going into the details, the city sort of backed away from the initial two ideas. There are now about seven or eight proposals on the table. The mayor appointed a 16-member expert advisory panel. But as I look at that panel and Tom writes on it, I see maybe two or three people of color. Mm-hmm. I don't see anybody representing the UJ or environmental community. And I don't see a lot of rhetoric around resilience and climate change related to that project. So I pose that as a question to some of the panelists for what would you do differently there? What would you add to it based on the conversation that you've given us today?
Well, can I please answer this? It's top of mind for me lately. Two issues. The panel needs to investigate whether tearing down the BQE is also an option and what that could look like. And secondarily, needs to be expanded to the entire city. There have been communities that have been asking for their highways to be capped for a very long time. And this commission needs to also look at, you know, the Sheridan Expressway, the BQE in Williamsburg, the FDR Drive, and, you know, on and on the Prospect Expressway. This has been an issue that communities have been asking for. And until we expand to think about this citywide, what are the traffic implications? What are the health implications? What are the climate implications? We're really not going to be doing our jobs.
All right, I'm told we're going to wrap it up. So please join me in extending a warm thank you to our panelists.